Hello and welcome to the Yogi Therapist Podcast. I'm your host, Shelby, a licensed mental health counselor and 200-hour certified yoga teacher living in Boston, Massachusetts. Through interviews with wellness professionals and discussions that infuse health, yoga, and psychology, we'll learn accessible ways to live an authentic, ethical, and non-toxic lifestyle. It's episode 13 of the Yogi Therapist Podcast, and today my guest is my friend Wilhelm, who is a meditation teacher here in Boston. I've known Wilhelm for a couple years, and I've had the amazing, immense pleasure to have sat with him in meditations that he's guided me through. And I can say that every time, I've had some like trippy experiences, but I've really, really enjoyed meditating with him. He has a naturally very soothing voice, as you will hear, and he is so intentional with his meditation offerings and his guidance. As you'll hear in this episode, he makes meditation sound extremely accessible, and he really wants it to feel accessible to everyone and anyone. I feel really lucky to have sat down with Wilhelm. We talked about a lot of different things. It was really exciting to get to know him better and hear about his life growing up in post-apartheid South Africa. It was also just really cool to hear his interesting journey to finding meditation and becoming a meditation teacher. He actually graduated from the New School of Yogic Arts as well in a different year, and he went through the training and at the end decided, I don't think I want to be a yoga teacher. So I think that this episode will be really useful for folks who go through a training and then maybe decide that they're just not quite sure that teaching yoga is the way to go, and perhaps meditation resonates more with them. It's actually really funny that I'm releasing this episode today, and it just happened to work out in order of, you know, which recordings I have and which one I wanted to release next. But I actually attended an amazing conference through the Harvard Medical School this weekend on meditation and psychotherapy. So I'm like loving meditation right now. And I think that after this episode, you will too, because he really does an excellent job explaining about how meditation, again, just can be for everyone. He shares some insight into how to make a meditation practice work for you. He talks about his own experience when practicing meditation and some barriers that he encountered when he first started. He shares a bit about his personal life, such as coming out when he was a young man growing up in South Africa. He talks about how to reframe your 9-to-5 when you have a side hustle, because he does have a job that he does full time, and meditation right now, teaching meditation, is his side hustle. So I thought that was really useful, especially given, you know, this podcast is my side hustle, I guess you could call it that. And I have a 9-to-5, but anyway, I'll let you hear the episode. Overall, we talk about all the things, and shocker, we also talk about using social media mindfully. You know I have to like talk about that every episode. So anyway, it's an incredible episode. I know that it's going to be really inspiring for you, and that hopefully it'll encourage you to maybe dabble a little bit and try some different forms of meditation. If you live in the Boston and Brookline area, though, you should absolutely check out Wilhelm's workshop, which is Saturday, May 11th from 1:30 to 3 p.m. at Coolidge Yoga Brookline. It's called Beyond the Cushion, Meditations for the Moment, and it is going to be absolutely incredible. So definitely, if you're someone who has experience meditating, or if you are looking to learn more about meditation, get into it, you should absolutely check this out. It's going to be awesome. You'll explore different meditation poses, different techniques. He talks about making it accessible in your day-to-day life. There's going to be different forms of meditation shared, including sitting, walking, standing, reclined meditation poses. There's going to be discussions, room for journaling, practicing. It just sounds incredible. So definitely check it out. I really encourage you to go meet Wilhelm in person and let him know if you listened to this episode and you connected with him in that way. I think that would be really cool to hear about. So go grab your meditation cushion if you've got one, or, you know, whatever you're doing, and let's learn about meditation from Wilhelm. Yeah. You're not allergic to cats, are you?
My immunity has actually gone up a lot, so an hour or two exposure is fine. Also, you, like, keep it clean here, so not everything is covered in cat hair.
Yeah.
Stay over here, Mama.
No worries. Short of me, like, petting Coco and then, like, rubbing it in my eyes, I should be quite okay.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had, actually, like, a couple people over, and they're like, yeah, I'm allergic. I'm like, no!
bring on that cat vaccine. I'm so excited for it.
Are they really making one?
It's been rumors for a while that they are getting close to developing a cat allergy vaccine.
Wow.
Which I'm like, oh. Please.
Oh my goodness.
Miracle of science, please.
I should tell my sister-in-law, because her and her fiance are both, like, allergic. Mm. She may have been always allergic, but she moved out of her parents' house, and then all of a sudden, every time she goes back, they have two cats. She's like, cannot breathe. Poor girl.
Yeah.
So, can you please tell my listeners, like, a little bit about yourself and where you're from and whatever is relevant to your story?
Everything that's relevant to my story is, it's fun because so many people ask you, you know, where are you from? And often people will pick up, I have an accent. And it's like, where I'm from is only the beginning of the story. But it is really enjoyable to kind of walk people through those steps. But I was born in South Africa, pre-end of apartheid South Africa. And that, you know, that has an impact on a person. But the majority of my life, I lived in post-apartheid South Africa. So living in a time where the conversation about inclusivity and race was so vivid and day-to-day has such an interesting impact on how you continue forward. And then I lived in the Netherlands for a while. And then when I was 18, I moved to San Diego with my family. And all of this, I swear, comes back to meditation, but what was so amazing about San Diego was just how different and warm and welcoming it was, and then from there, I kind of felt empowered to take my own path, and I wanted to go study languages. Mm-hmm. So I went to UC Santa Cruz, which is one of the world's best linguistics programs, and it was just such a delight, and while I was there, I broke my ankle, which was probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because there was one exercise that I could do, which was yoga. It was the only thing where I could go slow enough, adapt enough to, like, get a useful exercise and not accidentally, like, play around on this ankle that took a long time to recover. And so I got into yoga, started taking teacher training with warrior yoga teachers, and it was so profound. But already I knew that, like, I like the postures and I really enjoy the movement, but it's what is happening to my mind that is so interesting, you know? Because sometimes I would be there, I was like, why could I not find any peace in this entire meditation flow? And yet I feel really good afterwards. Mm. Or other times I'm like, I'm in it and I can feel my muscles and my bones moving. And it's like, what is happening here? And why can't I get any control over it? Then I fell in love with a wonderful man and I moved with him to Boston. And even though it didn't work out, it was like, it was meant to be. Boston just became my landing pad. And very quickly, I needed to find a yoga teacher, and lo and behold, I find Andrew Tanner, who you trained with as well, and he just showed me, it's like, wait, this thing's like, there's meditation, and there's yoga, and there's the way you live your life, and actually, you can completely flow from the one into the other. And what a discovery, you know, the first time that he got up there with his guitar and sang Hare Krishna. And I was like, what is this? I'm meditating, but I'm also moving. And it just, it like collapsed. And he had a announced he was doing a teacher training, and that's where I met Laura from your first episode. And I mean, what an unbelievable experience to be in the presence of both of these people. But again, that question kept coming up. It's like, I like the postures, I feel great when I'm doing them, but what's happening with my mind is really where it's all coming together for me and where my passion is. And at the end of the teacher training, and I know you did this too, you go around the circle and you try to summarize your experience, which is impossible. But I did say, I am stepping off the path here. I am not going to continue to become a yoga teacher. And that was the only way I could articulate what was going on with me, that I wanted to not do asana.
Yeah.
And it felt like such a betrayal. Like, oh, after all the anatomy and all the movement and everything, why did I walk away from that? But I knew already I would not have been an authentic teacher. And it took about a year and a half and a lot of coaching. And eventually someone was like, but why don't you become a meditation teacher? And I said, that's a thing that people can do. And they're like, yeah, absolutely, you know. And of course, anything you focus your passion on begins to fold around you. So suddenly my podcasts began changing, my book habits began changing, my sleeping habits, and everything that aligned with my passion for meditation kind of came together. So that's the story, you know. And I promise you, every time somebody asks me, hey, where are you from? Like, that entire narrative, like, runs through my head. And I just really like, where do I even begin?
Yeah.
So the great thing about podcasts is I get to tell that whole narrative. So what I do now, meditation teaching is my part-time job, although sometimes I think about it more than my actual job. But I am a program coordinator. I fall into the realm of event planning.
Mm-hmm.
And those two are actually very close to each other in a lot of ways, because events are special.
Mm-hmm.
They are a good event, actually induces a specific mind state. If you're doing an event that is about getting people to donate, you're trying to generate a mind state of generosity.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing an event that's like a wedding, you're trying to generate a mind state of compassion and love and commitment. And truly, meditation is very much the same. You're trying to generate these mind states in people and find out where is their gateway to meditation. I am currently studying with Lauren Roche and Camille Emmerine, who are all about the gateways. Fall into what you love. And if you walk away from an event feeling lighthearted and impassioned, you've engaged in a group meditation. You don't even know it.
Yeah.
So that is what I do right now. I teach 2 to 3 times a week.
Wow.
With yogis, students, and it's just everything that I love. And I love that it's in a city.
Yeah.
I love that I don't have a monastery that like I'm trying to pull people to. It's like, well, you know, I know you're going to your 9 to 5 after this, so like let's make you fall in love with the city you're in.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
How do you find, you know, balancing teaching meditation and offering it to students with working full time? Because like you said, you know, I find myself sometimes getting so excited by all my interests outside of my full time job, sometimes more than my full time job. And I think sometimes that can lower my mood, I guess I'll say very generally. But how do you sort of balance that? I don't know. I don't really know what I'm asking, but...
But it's the same frustration I hear with a lot of, especially the new graduates from the yoga schools. Yeah. It's like, I am so gung-ho, but I am like terrified to give up my 9 to 5 in order to pursue this fully. And honestly, unless you're 100% sure, you shouldn't. Like, our society is so wrapped up in the 9 to 5. That's why we get our health insurance through it. It's why we get, you know, our promise of hopefully a good retirement, which is in this package of 9 to 5.
Yeah.
So embrace that and use it as a as a stable platform.
Right.
And so I changed my relationship to it, being like, I love my 9-to-5 so much and I could live on that alone.
Yeah.
But I love it even more because it lets me do this side job that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I stopped resenting it, a lot of things just changed internally as well. But
what a great reframe.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of necessary, because you begin resenting either your 9-to-5 or you begin resenting your part-time job for not getting the love and attention that you want to give it. So when you hold these two things in a relationship, you actually have to nourish that relationship.
Like, that was incredible. That's meditation right there. Like, that's it. That's so cool. So you mentioned when we first sat down before we started recording that you have a bit of a ritual that you do occasionally before you go and lead a meditation. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about that, and then we'll kind of maybe wind back and talk a little bit more about your approach and what style of meditation you offer.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does fall into my approach, balancing between your work obligations, but still wanting to be in a place where you can show up for your students. We were laughing about this earlier, but a different conversation, but there is that phrase, don't trust a skinny cook. And first of all, that was from a previous podcast of yours. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And I agree, you can absolutely trust a skinny cook, but you wouldn't trust a doctor that feels unhealthy to be around. In the same way, I don't want to walk into a meditation class with waves of anxiety rolling off me, or an emotion that is uncontrolled. I can absolutely walk into a space full of emotion, but have that be generative to the vibe, as opposed to walking in with an uncontrolled emotion. So before I walk in, it's really important for me to ground myself. And I do that with green tea. Green tea is wonderful for keeping you sharp and focused if you can handle the caffeine. And I am in love with the element of water. Like, I can be around water all the time. So just that act of pouring water into a cup and watching how it moves and stays still, that only takes 10 minutes or so, but you can transform yourself when you're in front of your students just by having that little grounding ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I do consider that sacred time. If I can, I journal, I get my thoughts out, so that especially having to take public transportation to my classes, you don't know what is going to come your way when public transportation and the energy and the mood of the people around you. So just taking that time is so important to me. And I think that's enough said about that. But,
but yeah, and it to me, it sounds like too, it sets a boundary of you sort of putting your life, whatever's going on hold to come in and offer space to others.
Absolutely. I would even go further and say that that's a good time to reflect on what's going into your life and if any of it is useful to bring into the meditation that you're about to lead. I, for instance, showed up soaked today because it's raining and everything, but I love water, so I don't mind.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I'm soaked, but I love water. So how do I, like, convey that like you can engage with one of the elements and feel comforted by that? And it's like, okay, so today's meditation can be about my relation with elements. And so I took a little bit of part of my life that was relevant and brought it into the teaching. So again, that little 10 minute space is so powerful and useful to bring into meditation class, because whereas I feel like in an asana class, if a teacher comes in with a vibe, which I know great teachers don't, you know, they create that facilitative space, but a student can maybe work that vibe out as they're moving. But in a meditation class, they're going to be more receptive to what you're putting out there because they're kind of sitting still or lying down.
Yeah.
So I find it personally just really important to manage my vibe, you know, before I bring it.
How are you so chill? Like, how are you able to have that awareness of, as you're talking, you're able to, like, take that step back and really consciously make a decision on how you want to engage with your emotions?
Yeah. Practice. Absolutely. One of my favorite memories in my life was sitting at the communal table that I had at my house in college, and a med student asked me the same thing. And she said, you know, well, Adam, you're just like the calm center of this house. And I looked at her and was like, if you had told me 3 years ago that somebody would call me the calm center of anything, I would not have believed you. I would have laughed and fallen off my chair. And it was just a mark of that subconsciously things had been changing for me. And that is entirely due to the practice of yoga and meditation. Wow. But it is a choice.
Yeah.
And I want to draw a very important line here. And again, from the teachings of the Radiant Sutras and Dr. Lauren Roche, is that is always a choice. Choosing to be chill is not making a good choice. It's just the choice that you want to make now.
Mm.
When I walk into a party, I amp myself up. That is my choice to not be chill, because I don't want to be chilling at a party. I want to be like engaging and active.
Yeah.
And knowing that you have access to these emotions allows you to live a really full and fun life. So right now we're talking about meditation, so I thought I should be chill.
That's amazing. What would you recommend to someone who maybe has never meditated before, let's change that. Can you maybe speak a little bit more about the Radiant Sutras and your work with Dr. Lauren Roche? Because I'm vaguely familiar with him through one of my yoga teachers, but I don't know his sort of methodology or approach to meditation. I'm more of like Jon Kabat-Zinn, as I constantly gush.
Yeah, but who's also amazing. I'm very new to actually being in his and his wife's teacher training, but
you're in a teacher training now.
I'm in a teacher training now with him, and I actually just came from a weekend at Kripalu where I met him, and it was very. So I want to say that what I'm saying is only my beginner understanding, but in the short bit that I can summarize is, our inheritance of meditation comes from the Eastern traditions, and they come primarily from monastic traditions, which are so beautiful in their own way. But why a lot of people struggle with them is because it becomes a discipline.
Mm.
And that discipline has been supported by a monastic setting. There's a reason that monks get taken care of, that they don't wear, you know, a lot of different clothes and spend a lot of time in silence, because a monastery supports that. But there is a whole population of people out there that have children, that are in families that have 9-to-5s, and to try and apply them is difficult. It works for a lot of people, but it also doesn't work for a lot of people. So Dr. Roche's approach is based on a beautiful text called the Bhairava Tantra, and it's a conversation between the god and the goddess. And it's the goddess asks, I've looked at this world and its energies and its matter, and how do I get to know it more deeply? And the god says, by going into it more deeply.
Mm.
And then here's 112 ways to do that. and so that has many names. The one that I love is the path of intimacy.
Mm.
As juxtaposition to the path of renunciation. And I picked up the book, I read it once, I was like, oh, this is cute. And then, because, you know, you're not ready for a thing unless you're ready for it.
Yeah.
I picked it up again a couple of months ago, and the words were blazing off the text. And I said, oh, this is what I've been waiting for. Everything that I've been thinking about meditation is here.
Wow.
And so I took the leap, decided to get into the teacher training, and I can already feel how my practice has transformed, and it's beautiful. And I gotta say, it's a wild ride. Like, you know, I've never had somebody say, when you wake up in the morning and your inner rebel is saying, I don't want to meditate, you just like stand there next to your meditation cushion and you honor that inner rebel and you talk to it until maybe you want to sit down, and then you keep your eyes open because your inner rebel is still there until finally your eyes close. Yeah. Or maybe that doesn't happen at all, but it's so authentic. And a lot of people don't know that meditation is space for that.
Yeah.
A lot of people would immediately think like, well, you know, if I'm committing to this meditation, I'm going to sit on that cushion whether I want to or not.
Right.
And believe me, that generates results. It did for me too, but it is a barrier. Anyway, I can go on for hours about this.
I kind of do want you to continue. Like, how would you say it is a barrier? Because I know for myself, sometimes I'll be like, oh, I just don't want to meditate right now, but I know that I need it. And then I end up sitting for 20 minutes and I finally, at the 18 minute mark, maybe feel like I meditate. And then I get maybe a minute and a half in.
Okay.
I can't tell if that's like wasted time or...
Okay, so... Yeah. So speaking of barriers, there's a reframing of what is meditation. So you said, after the 18th minute, I meditated. No, you were meditating from the moment you sat down because that frustration, restlessness you were feeling is something that you had to work through. Serenity does not equal meditation. It's half of the coin. The restlessness, the movement, is your body saying, well, I've got something going on here and I want you to process that. And then your mind is going, no, you're not allowed to process this right now. Yeah. And suddenly there's conflict and that's not meditative. But what if you did let it move through you? What if you're like, oh, this restlessness is so amazing because my body wants to keep me alive. And it says, like, you've got a thing to do. You've got a thing to process. And you just sit there going, like, oh, wow, look at these millions of years of evolution that are running through me right now. Huh. And that is meditation. Yeah. But it's, I will say this sounds like great and wonderful, but there's such a reframing that has to happen about our cultural understanding of what meditation is and can be in order for that to feel natural.
Did you have any barriers when you came to the practice?
Yes. So I am a perfectionist, which is one of my superpowers. But the great thing about...
Great reframe.
Just like Superman shouldn't be shooting lasers out of his eyes all the time. So did I have to learn to apply my perfectionism at times when it made sense? I'm referencing the work of Dr. Jeff Szymanski, who is my boss and literally wrote the book on perfectionism. Wow. But again, it's that reframing of when I'm planning an event, I want to be a perfectionist. There's no reason for me not to be a perfectionist. So before I got a good grip on my perfectionism, the inherited meditation traditions are so good at asking you to be a perfectionist. They want you to buckle down and say, like, you know, every thought that comes in is a distraction. Eliminate all thoughts. Every, you know, don't move, for instance.
Yeah.
And that speaks so much to my perfectionistic tendency.
Yeah.
But then when I walked away from the meditation going, well, that was a waste of meditation because halfway through I needed to stretch, I was not in alignment. I wasn't in alignment with my body and my mind. That took years to get over.
Wow.
Because who wouldn't want to be a radiant Buddha? I mean, that's just the most gorgeous image.
Yeah.
And then every time that you have that image and you're not in love, you're striving for it, but you're not in love with it because it's an object that is out of your reach, resentment can come up, frustration can come up. So that would say was absolutely my biggest obstacle.
Wow. Yeah. And I appreciate how you... Speaking of adjusting your position, I'm just going to change how I'm sitting. So, sorry, folks.
No,
so, I appreciate that you point out that that type of meditation, the like quiet the mind, don't think of thoughts, don't move, you know, how that can play into perfectionistic tendencies that one might have, because like I identify so hard with that. So in your practice, when you're offering meditation to folks, are you, you know, are you actively telling them, like, if you have an itch, scratch it. If you need to move, move. You know, like, how do you sort of approach that in your practice and offering?
That is a continuing thing that I'm trying to figure out for myself, because I'm very wary of not talking too much during meditation and making space for silence. So I don't want to be reminding them constantly that movement is fine, scratching an itch is fine. Just that, you know, you love it when you do it. But suddenly I want to bring that entire philosophy of like millions of years of evolution, and, you know, like love your body for wanting to move, things like that. And it's like finding ways to be succinct and let that message come across is difficult. In asana, potentially you could talk the entire time. I love her for this, Laura. Laura,
it's like, yeah, that's exactly where my brain went to.
Like, you know, she's just waves of loving kindness and ideas running through you.
Prolific speech.
But I do think that that silence is important to incorporate into a meditation teaching. So, short answer is I don't have an answer for that. It's hard when you're passionate about a thing.
Yes.
You're like, I want to tell you all the things. Yeah. Like, well, why don't we skip the meditation class and just have a conversation right? about this? That's not why your students are there. Especially because of what I mentioned earlier, that in meditation, what you need to process arises for you. And you want to generate a cultivating and loving space for that. And I love saying to my students, you know, you've just walked in here. I don't know what you're stressed about, but the moment you close your eyes, you're going to know exactly what you're stressed about, because your brain is going to be like, hey, we have some time. Let's begin.
Yeah.
You know, we've got, remember that guy who yelled at you on the bus? Like, have you had time to sit with that yet?
Yeah.
And the other part of your brain is like, shh, I need to meditate. It's like, no, I really think you should process this, and to let your students know that you're going to feel better for having processed it, and that is called meditation. It's a long and ongoing conversation. I really like one-on-one sessions, because then you can begin to generate a creative meditation approach that suits them.
Yeah,
it's very different than sitting in front of a group of people. You're like, I can't have one-on-ones with you all, so instead I'm going to try and generate space that you feel comfortable with whatever arises. Teaching meditation is tricky, and you have to be creative. You really, really do. And I like to say that, like, you know, in asana, if your student is sweating, you're like, all right, I know something's happening here, but most of my students can sit down and I can get a sense, perhaps, that they are more rested. And then they'll walk out, and I just don't know what experience they had. Right. And perhaps if I had a big obstacle in meditation for myself, my biggest obstacle in meditation teaching was having to let go of any kind of validation. Because unless they come up to you and say, oh, I had this great experience or this terrible experience, I'm never going to know.
Yeah.
And that's tough.
Yeah. How do you sit with that? Because even right now, I'm sort of like, as you're telling me about it, I'm like, ooh, I feel a little bit of anxiety coming up.
Mm-hmm. I have to sit with it. I'm sitting with a question right now, because I think my answer has changed over time.
Yeah.
Initially, I tried to practice non-attachment, but I have an ego, and I would like to know that people are enjoying my classes.
Yeah.
And so instead, I really do try to tune a little bit more into my students and build an energetic sense of, like, I do think this person is more relaxed, or I do think this person felt moved, And that's a way that I can kind of sense what's going on without being intrusive, without like grabbing them at the end of class, being like, did you have a good experience? Yeah. And that has been comforting as well. Plus, it's actually a good, important practice for any teacher to get more comfortable with sensing out the vibes of their students. So that's my answer for now. Ask me in 10 months and we'll see.
Yeah. You mentioned before when you were speaking about getting creative with meditation, you know, how do you get creative with your teachings?
A bit of what I mentioned before, what's going on in my life that I think is worthwhile for my students to learn. Also, the creativity is especially important for me because my students are living in a city and they are householders. So, whereas in a monastery one can go and sit down and learn this one technique and get so good at it, but you've got years to do it, I want to give my students a lot of different approaches because one or two of them's got to stick. If, you know, evoking the senses works incredibly well, and especially if you find yourself attuned to eyesight, I would love for my students who drive a car every day to begin incorporating eyesight into their meditation while driving, because then they begin to have that generative healing experience. But it's theirs. You know, I'm never going to teach them, like, well, when you're turning onto the I-93, think this or look at that. But I want them to be like, well, I'm on the I-93 every day. Why don't I look at it differently and look at the colors of the billboards and look at the colors of the different cars whizzing by? So the creativity that I want to bring in is to motivate to bring my students' creativity. So I don't write out a script ahead of time. A lot of it kind of flows out of me. I know which points I want to touch, but what comes, what fills those points in between, allows me to be creative and in the moment. So that's a lot of it, honestly. You get good at improvising as well. When you're a meditation student and one of your students like says, I've only got 15 minutes, is it okay if I come in for only half the class? Like, I can improvise. I can work around that. And that is, of course, a thing that Laura was so good at teaching us to make it a narrative. So I think that's all I got on that one.
I wonder if you could speak to people that... I might sneeze. Hang on.
Go for it.
Nope. It was coming. So annoying. It keeps like creeping up. Okay, let me just take a moment. So, what about the person that is like, nope, I can't meditate, super resistant, not maybe intentionally resistant, but maybe there's fear and they are afraid to be sitting with their thoughts, or they're really skeptical about meditation? What might you say to that person?
Or all of those things at once. So the one thing I would say to anyone who says they can't meditate is it's already built in. A lot of people get scared of meditation because they don't like the implied mysticism that goes with it. This was something that Rachel Berstow said a while ago. It's like, you can not believe in chakras, but you can believe in glands, because you've got glands. In the same way, I can say, you can not believe in meditation, but you can believe in your nervous system, because you have a nervous system. In fact, you have two. You've got the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And we're very good at activating our sympathetic nervous system and getting ourselves stressed because, you know, this is the city. But you already have an inbuilt parasympathetic nervous system. So what I would say to somebody who's struggling to, like, even want to touch meditation is to say, reframe it as a way for you to engage your parasympathetic nervous system. And there's a reason we have it. It also allows us to survive. We're very focused on how our stress response in us is to survive, but our relaxed response also allows us to survive because it recalibrates us. Mm. It gets us ready for the next day so we can do it better. When you come home at the end of the day and you turn on your TV and you get your beer, that is you actually beginning to engage this nervous system of yours, because you feel better. It allows you to process the day, and then the next day you're good. Mm. So that's to answer you, perhaps the skeptic or the person who doesn't want to engage in any of that woo-woo stuff. The person who is afraid of what comes up, that is very valid. Mm. And that's when you kind of dip your toe into the waters of meditation, and you say, first you make yourself very comfortable. Build a pillow fort if you have to. Lie down. You don't have to sit with a straight spine in order to meditate. And then take 5 minutes. You know, set your timer for 5 minutes and focus on your breathing, perhaps, you know, or just look at a beautiful view and tune in and say, okay, so what's coming up when I'm allowing my brain to think? And depending on that response, if you have a strong, vivid response, if trauma comes up, then maybe good time to think about going to see a therapist instead. But at least you're doing it with an informed idea. Mm-hmm. If it felt pleasant, you can begin to move further until something pops up, and then you begin to work with that. One thing I definitely advise is if you are a person who feels like a lot is going to come up, stand. Ground, like feel like you're standing on a mountain and you're like, I am going to bring it on right now. Standing is a great tradition.
Oops, sorry. Come here, Coco. I'm so sorry.
Okay, Coco.
Come here, Mom. Sorry, she's so curious. What else is new, guys? Coco's just crashing the pod.
Yeah, so just to reemphasize that last point, bring, you know, if you want to meditate from a position of strength, like ground your feet, feel your thighs, and then say, I'm going to breathe into this space. So I think, well, that answers the skeptic, that answers the person who's afraid. I feel like I had a third person. I can't even remember.
Well, I, you know, it's funny. I've never, ever heard anyone say, like, to recommend standing. Mm-hmm. If you feel, you know, maybe a little bit of fear or worry going into your practice. And I'm definitely, the perfectionist in me comes out that wants to be like, oh, I need the perfect moment to meditate. Like, I need to not be really stressed and I just need to feel good. And like, that's so not the reality.
Of course we want to meditate in an area that has less distractions and is not stressful.
Yeah.
Because that's facilitates. But it's a good place to start your conversation. You want to become intimately familiar with someone. You're not first going to go to a rave with them. You know? Eventually you might, because you find out that in your relationship, this is exactly where you most thrive together. Same way with meditation. If you find out that dancing your heart out is your meditation path, you're going to get there. But it probably starts in a quiet, serene place until you're like, I can't deal with this silence, like, turn on the EDM. you know? But all of that is authentic, and all of that is a relationship with meditation. So, that's what I'll say about that.
So it sounds like it's really important to recognize what one's relationship is with meditation, rather than perhaps trying to conform to a specific idea of meditation?
Yes, unless, again, that idea works for you.
Yes.
You walk into Cambridge Insight Center and it answers all your questions, then go there. Yeah. Love it. You know, if sitting cross-legged with a straight spine is how you want to meditate 50% of the time, go for it. Yeah. And again, Dr. Roche is so good at saying that. He's like, I'm not knocking sitting with a straight spine. I do it half the time. But it's always a choice.
Yeah.
Building a relationship with meditation is so worthwhile, because it allows you to welcome a great amount of yourself.
Mm.
If while you're in meditation, that's what happens with me, I'll share, there are times when, like, the armor comes on and I see my mental sword, you know, I'm like, yeah. Okay, my inner soldier is coming out right now. That's a fantastic thing that meditation taught me. It's like, and I would never have gotten there unless I didn't welcome these more aggressive parts of myself mm. into my meditation practice. But it's so easy to say, like, oh, you shouldn't be feeling aggression mm. in your meditation. That's how anti-meditative is that.
Yeah.
So it's such a wonderful adventure. I recommend it for the world, of course.
Yes, yes.
Because you do find yourself calm when you want to be. You find yourself excited when you want to be mm. and your control over your life begins to build day by day, month by month, year by year.
Yeah.
And what a practice. Just what a practice.
Yeah. What would you say has been, you know, and I wonder if maybe anything came up for you this weekend, but anything that has been more transformative for you since beginning your meditation practice or your journey as a meditation teacher?
I mean, it's a plethora of things, so yeah. I'm just going to sink into that question for a little bit.
Yeah. It's a loaded question, Coco, right?
Mm-hmm. Coco's looking at me like, you better answer this correctly.
There's no right or wrong.
What has been truly amazing on my journey is to be unapologetically joyous.
Yeah.
And that is so liberating. Yeah, there are barriers, like as a man, if a man comes in and says, you know, I am in love with this thing, you have to just, like, you can immediately feel how some people put their guard up to that, like, well, what is this exposure to, like, passion? Like, I don't ask for passion in this conversation. And to let it do its thing has been so amazing for me. As a gay man growing up in South Africa, I had such a fascinating response from my friends. And of course, they were teenagers. We were all figuring this out. But there was like, you know, this is you and we celebrate it. And it was wow. But just don't like kiss a guy in front of me because... And I'm like, yeah, no, totally understand. This is yeah. my thing. You don't have to, like, deal with it.
Mm.
And then I came to America, and I was like, what the hell was that? You know? But I had to learn to let my emotions flow, to let my passions show themselves, mm. and to be unapologetic about that. And I couldn't have done it without meditation. Mm. When you're that aware of how rich your inner life is, which everyone has the most amazing inner life, you know, you can't, it feels so weird to hide that.
Yeah.
And that's me as a personality. Some people are very comfortable hiding that, but I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that it's been so liberating for you and just to be able to work more towards your more authentic self, as I say way too often, but...
Authenticity is an interesting word in today's culture,
yeah.
and we have to sometimes reclaim it a little bit and be more specific about it, because otherwise you do also fall to that ooh language
right.
that can be off-putting to people.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah.
How, you know, would you say any of your, you know, your cultural background or your upbringing in South Africa, does that influence your meditation practice or your teaching at all?
Definitely. Yeah. So shout out to all South Africans who are possibly listening, but I think you'll agree with this, is that we are by and by sociable creatures. Mm. We really do gather a lot and socialize with each other a lot. And we have that shared culture, you know, as speaking, of course, as a white South African, we have a lot of shared culture around sports and cooking and, and so I guess I'll speak for white South Africans, which is important because South Africa is a rainbow nation and just all these different tribes are reclaiming their language and their traditions after having been suppressed by apartheid for so long. I mean, there are a number of tribes officially in South Africa, but honestly, like, there were so many more tribes than were ever officially recognized. So,
wow.
I speak to that because, again, it's that celebration of your individuality and celebration of your culture that you're in that I want to bring to the people that I teach with. Like, if a Red Sox fan shows up in my class, like, I want them to feel like meditatively they can celebrate being in love with the Red Sox. Yeah. Because I will always hate the New Zealand rugby team. It's just, it's in me, and I love how irrational it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they have defeated the South African rugby team time and time again. So, coming from a passionate nation, and coming from a nation with such complicated, terrible, and beautiful history, I wouldn't want to deny any of that or think of any of that as unmeditative. So I bring it in as much as I can. I mean, I also, Nelson Mandela was my first president. And like, talk about a meditation master right there, with an open heart that, in my opinion, took a country that could have gone into civil war and navigated it with understanding and compassion. And, like, that was my background growing up. Yeah. So how fortunate am I?
Yeah. It's clear that Nelson Mandela inspires you.
Absolutely.
Has inspired you. Who else would you say? You know, you mentioned Dr. Lauren Roche, Laura Ahrens, Andrew Tanner. Who else would you say really inspires you?
I'm incredibly inspired by therapists, you know, and I love that I am on a podcast that I'm hoping therapists listen to, because I work for a nonprofit that works in the mental health field, and that dedication to validating the mind, which I'm doing in my way, but for you come, all therapists sit with people who are in conflict with their own mind most of the time, and to begin to validate it, begin to work with it, and to say what seems impossible to you is something we can actually work with. Like, the idea that you can come back to a more fulfilled life, a passionate sex life, a beautiful relationship with the people, all of that is the work of meditation, just as much. So I am inspired by what I see in my work and the conversations that I have with therapists, because what a time to be alive. So much of this did not exist 50 years ago, did not exist 100 years ago. Krista Tippett said it a long time ago, but I think neuroplasticity is possibly one of the greatest promises of this upcoming century, that we have learned that we are not set in our ways. All of that is amazing to me. And I feel so inspired by that.
Come here. I'm trying to make sure she doesn't jump up on you. Is there any literature that you might recommend, or a starting point for folks if they are looking to start a meditation practice on their own?
Absolutely. Obviously, go with what inspires you, but it's literally called Meditation Made Easy. It's written by Dr. Lauren Roche, and it's a lot of what I've spoken about today. Again, I don't have any original ideas, but
no one does, right?
Right. It's called Meditation Made Easy.
Yeah.
It's all about how do you do a little bit of meditation here, a little bit of meditation there. How do you sit with your thoughts and you create a loving relationship with them? If you want to start from scratch, I couldn't recommend this book more. If you have a meditation practice and you're looking for that sort of next level, I invite you to be creative. There is the most amazing podcast out there called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, which what stunned me about that was these people realized that in their moments of need of comfort, in their moments of need of inspiration, they turned to their childhood book of Harry Potter and developed such a beautiful scholarly relationship with it, that I do think they have tapped into a meditation practice there. So whatever it is you turn to, if it's the Gita, if it's the Bible, the Quran, if it is your childhood book, bring it into your practice. Mm. Begin reading it, and then notice what happens in your body and how what thoughts arise as you study it. So if you've been meditating for a long time, bring in that creativity. It'll take it to a depth and a level that you never knew could be there.
Well, and how lovely to offer people permission to get creative too with their meditation practice, because I think that in my teaching students at my job about meditation, a lot of times I find that they presume that there is this right way to do it or a specific way to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the case at all.
No, it really isn't.
No one size fits all meditation.
I absolutely honor the thousands of years of meditation traditions that have survived, because the richness of it is they've been also been thinking about it for so long. And that's why in those traditions you'll find so much that resonates with you. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say they never saw cell phones coming. They never saw the internet coming.
Right.
So now we have this space and time to bring up the conversation again.
Mm.
And I do hope that people bring up the conversation of their spirituality, mysticism, and meditation again. Well, how would it work in this setting?
Yeah. Speaking of the internet, do you have any recommendations or any practices that you do on your own of how you mindfully engage with social media?
Yeah, I love that you bring up this question so much with so many of your interviews, because it is so relevant. And it's a continual thing that this is what I say, and Netflix, you beautiful monster, Netflix, many of us open up Netflix and we are like overwhelmed because there's so much to offer.
Yeah.
And I at least with my perfectionistic tendencies really want to watch all of it. Like, what if I miss out on that one show that's so amazing?
Mm.
And a mindfulness practice with that is to say, I'm not going to watch anything in order to complete it. I'm only going to watch what I love. So when I turn on Queer Eye, it's like, because right now I want to engage with the saints of self-care, which is how I refer to them.
Yes.
Like, I love imagining them with halos around their head, you know. Or, you know, I skip past Game of Thrones, even though I know everyone's going to be talking about Game of Thrones. But I love the OA, which is weird, but makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. So that is my mindfulness approach to Netflix, a lot of social media, and also the apps on my phone. Mm. And if I have a lot of apps on my phone because they're relevant at certain times, but I look at my phone, take a moment, and like, what would be the most fun that I could have on my phone right now? And then I go in that direction.
Mm.
And I know, and I acknowledge my part that says like, hey, but you know, what's on Instagram right now? Like, you know what? I'm going to enjoy more to tune into Harry Potter and the Sacred Text right now. And again, I'm developing a relationship. I want my phone to entertain me. I don't want to feel beholden to my phone to say, well, that I have to look at everything that's in it. Because who cares?
Yeah.
My phone doesn't care that I look at everything that's in it. But that's easier said than done. So that's my current practice.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So where can folks meditate with you? Wait, Coco. Coco's like, I'm going to meditate with you.
There you go. Okay. So at the moment, I teach two classes on Monday morning and Wednesday morning. And the time's a little bit tricky. It's from 7:30 to 8. It follows the yoga class that runs from 6:30 to 7:30. Monday mornings, it's at South End Coolidge Yoga, and on Wednesday mornings, it's at the Brookline Coolidge Yoga. I am actively trying to find a space where I can do evening meditations. So shout out to anybody that hears that.
I might have a recommendation for you.
Great. Mm-hmm. Because I think evenings are a great time to meditate. Mornings are also a great time to meditate. So I will definitely keep announcing new opportunities as they come up. And if anybody is interested in this sort of creative approach, as part of my training, I am also working with students, so I can be reached at consider today boston@gmail.com. And if you're interested in this approach, like, please reach out to me.
Mm-hmm. And you have a workshop coming up.
Thank you for reminding me. Yes. So a workshop based around a lot of this work as well will be at Coolidge Corner on May 11th. Just check out their website, coolidgeyoga.com.
And that's at the Brookline location?
That's at the Brookline location.
Amazing.
Yeah. Which is a lot about this. Like, how do I meditate when I stand? How do I meditate when I lie down? When I walk? All of which have also honorable traditions in a lot of Buddhism. So, yeah, if that is of interest to you, it's Saturday, May 11th.
Great. And where can people find you on social media?
So, honestly, in my relationship with social media, my email is as far as I really want to go.
Excellent.
So, again, that's consider today boston@gmail.com.
Perfect.
And I tried it. You know, I'll admit I tried the Instagram thing, but it's so hard to feel authentic by putting out an inspirational message or something. Like, I don't feel authentic when I did, so I kind of gave that up.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah.
And we, you know, I had this conversation with someone before. Like, businesses existed before social media. You know, we connected before social media. We don't need it to thrive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Marketing feels weird to me, although that is, again, a relationship, and I'm trying to get better at marketing.
Yeah.
But consider today boston@gmail.com.
Perfect. Well, this was absolutely incredible. I'm so grateful to you for coming on.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you're enjoying my podcast, please subscribe and post a review. It would make me so, so happy. I'd love to hear your thoughts, feelings, and suggestions for future topics and hosts, so feel free to contact me through social media or send an email over to theyogitherapist@gmail.com. I'm always open to your feedback, and I love connecting with you all. Until next time, namaste.